Show Me the Way, episode 16, The Attorney Who Became an Investment Banker. In this episode, we talk with Patrick Trisla of Frontier Investment Banking and his interesting professional career from attorney to investment banker. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain LLP about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. Joining me today is Pat Trisla, who I've known for well over 20 years, a Kansas Cityan who has been engaged to help a variety of businesses at all levels, including helping his customers with the exit of their businesses. Pat will share his secrets to successfully growing a business and how he has helped individuals sell their businesses. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate you having me.
Pat, let's share a little bit of your personal history and your back out, starting where you were born, where you're from, where you grew up, so people can understand who Pat Trisla is all about.
Well, that's pretty an exciting topic. I mean, I grew up in Nebraska, went to undergrad and law school at Nebraska. Matriculated to Kansas City, practiced in M&A and corporate finance, and got an unsolicited offer to join a boutique M&A investment banking firm in 99 and end of 99, beginning of 2000, and the rest is history. Not a very storied or glamorous history, but nonetheless history.
And that company is Frontier Investment Banking, is that correct?
Yes, I started with someone else and spun out and started Frontier in 2004. And so, yeah, it's similar to where I practice. It's focused on mergers and acquisition and corporate finance, but primarily what we do, three quarters and up, are we're representing sellers and helping them optimize in the sale of their business. And when I say sale of the business, I include, you know, sale of a portion of their business, and something that, as you well know, Dave, given your practice in the industry, is called a recap or recapitalization, where a business owner or owners are selling a percentage of their firm. If it's less than 50%, it's typically referred to as a minority recap, or if it's over 50%, a majority recap. So we view situations where our clients are, you know, selling a meaningful portion of their firm as a sell side opportunity. We do acquisition financing and some other corporate finance, growth capital, and things like that, fairness opinions for public companies, transactions, and things like that. But we're primarily sell side advisors.
So share with me and with my listeners, what experience in business, and I don't know if you can point to a specific deal. Obviously, we won't use names because we want to protect the innocent. But what experience for you is the most fun or enjoyable, if you can think of one or two?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll answer in general and then maybe some specifics. You know, in general, I enjoy putting together deals because, you know, and we've been blessed and dumb lucky here at Frontier to every engagement that we've had is ended up in a successful conclusion. So it's a win-win, you know. And so those of us that men and women of the cloth that are attorneys, you know, you've got in that fork in the road if you're going to litigate and scrap. And it's going to, most people say at the end of a piece of litigation, even if you're the winner, you're the loser. But when you're doing deals, you're bringing people together and you're, and so I enjoy that aspect of it. So that's in general. I mean, some specifics I'll pull from back in the day, and you'll remember this because when we first started practicing, most deals we closed in New York. And
right.
And because we were, you know, this is before dust off. There's some percentage of the listeners out there that might remember pre-faxes and certainly internet and things like that. But yeah, so it was kind of fun to get to New York and Chicago and San Francisco, but mainly New York to close deals and stuff like that. And, you know, as far as doing deals today, I think it's probably just, you know, just the varied number that we do here. I mean, we're industry agnostic, but through the years, and if you do it for 35 years, like I've been lucky enough to do, that you run across quite a few industries. But boy, nonetheless, every deal is a new deal, and certainly we learn on every deal. So that part is rewarding.
Let's look at the other side. I imagine there's some scenarios that were just very difficult for you. And I'm going to have a follow-up question on this, but can you remember or lead us into any scenarios that just were seemingly you felt impossible or, you know, just not very, not something you looked forward to, for lack of a better term, if I can say it that way?
Well, you know, we certainly have been part of sales where the selling parties weren't necessarily fully aligned. And so you're in addition to being a quote unquote deal person, or being an M&A investment banker, you're part counselor, part confidant. And really what you're trying to do is get those concentric circles of objectives to overlap in an area to get a deal done. So there's been sometimes there's, you know, families involved and you got the history of, you know, a lot of emotion and things like that. So for us, yeah, some of the challenging things can be the personalities associated with the deal. And as a quick aside, I often joke with my Wall Street brethren that they've got it easy. I mean, we've done this before, where we're selling a public company, as you well know, selling a public company, the stakeholders, the fiduciaries, the executive officers are duty bound to optimize for the shareholders. But in middle market deals where we live in the somewhere between the 20 to 500, $750 million range, and in that area, you get a lot of, there tend to be private companies. And with a private company, you have objectives that are other than optimizing shareholder value. Certainly valuation and money and cash at close and all that kind of stuff are important. But at the end of the day, there can be a lot of issues. It could be, you know, a small town and you want to keep the plan in that town and you want to keep it open. It could be that you've got a cousin in the business that is sacrosanct and cannot be fired, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, he or she is potentially not optimizing their job. And so, you know, we end up having to solve for not only optimizing valuation and optimizing terms and conditions of the sale, but also optimizing idiosyncratic objectives of our private company clients.
That is very good insight. It's about dealing with people and dealing with those people issues. On, you know, at least the deals I think I've seen more often than not in this area. Can you speak to the issue of deal fatigue? Because it comes up in every transaction, right? At some level. Even if you think as a professional, this is an easy one, there is some element of deal fatigue that people just become frustrated for a variety of reasons. Usually it's because of time or it's because of stress. Is that pretty common in M&As? Do you see that in every deal that you're involved with, or is that just perhaps an anomaly?
No, I think it's very common. It's not in every deal because sometimes you get lucky and they go kind of the way you thought. But, you know, inevitably or typically, there is an issue where the parties are going to get high-centered. Either it's going to take some more analysis, maybe some repricing, or maybe some structuring of the payment of the purchase price to manage to the risk associated with a particular issue. But yeah, when those things come up, if your clients have been emotionally, first of all, they're always emotionally invested in their business. And this is, you know, the largest transaction, tends to be the largest transaction of their life and, you know, their family's life. So it's an important transaction. So if they've been at it for a while and there's been some back and forth and maybe some egos have been involved and stuff like that, deal fatigue can be really problematic. And that's where seasoned, steady hands like I know you are, because we've been lucky enough to do deals with you and your clients, where you can, you got to sometimes pull your client aside and talk to them about, you know, stay focused and finish here. Just focus on the prize and get it done.
That is good insight. You've had an interesting career in as much as you've been involved in dealing with M&As as an attorney and then M&As as an investment banker. A real unique perspective. What did you see as an investment banker that you would have never seen as an attorney? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, well, maybe not as seen, but certainly focus on, I guess if I'm trying to anticipate where you're going with this.
Sure.
So just to try and cover this briefly for your listeners, I mean, what we do at the end of the day, if someone put a gun to my head and said, you got, you know, 10 seconds or X number of words to describe what you do, and I'd have to crassly say, we orchestrate a competitive, private, competitive marketing process or auction. And through that competition is how we drive value. And so one of the things that you know, and quite frankly, and you and I are old enough that we used to practice before there was an investment banking function out there, before it was even known. And most deals were negotiated deals. And then at times you could get some competition because you had more than a couple of interested buyers involved, but you wouldn't necessarily have them at the same stage. But your investment banker that's running a competitive, orchestrating a competitive marketing process, what they're trying to do is go out there and tell the story of the company. And really what you're doing is you're telling the history, the current situation, and the future of not only the company, but its industry. And then you're taking that and telling that story, amplifying the strengths and disclosing and managing to the weaknesses, taking that story to multiple. And in typical process for us, we'll go to well north of 500, really typically well north of 1,000 potentially interested, financially qualified buyers. And then they will bid to have the opportunity to finally meet our client somewhere down the rounds of bidding. And so that competitive process drives value like I never could when I used to practice law in a negotiated deal. I mean, if you're only negotiating leverages, we're walking away, or we're going to get more aggressive in the market against you, or, you know, something along that lines. It's not nearly as compelling as running a process and then having a situation where you could have interested buyers that maybe aren't in a situation where their balance sheet is such, or their current policy is they're not interested in buying, but they really want the company that's being sold. Well, the train's leaving the station, folks. So you're going to find out from an offensive standpoint whether they're interested. From a defensive standpoint, they might look at it and say, we got to get involved here because we don't end up with this company. Our competitor is. They're going to be that much more competitive to us. And so, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is, from an investment banker, we've been able to kind of helicopter above before it gets to the deal documentation stage, helicopter above during that competitive marketing process, you know, take in the interest of the different types and the different number of potential interested buyers, help them populate their pricing models so that they optimize, hopefully, the valuation for our client. And then our client chooses from the available offers after having talked with them and done diligence on the potential buyers. And then it goes to the documentation stage where I used to get involved. So the aspect to me that's been the most interesting, the most impactful, has been that part of being part of setting the valuation and creating the negotiating leverage that allows you to hopefully optimize in your deal.
Excellent. That's a good explanation. Thank you for letting me throw you that curveball, frankly. You know, a lot of times it seems to me that people will show up on my doorstep and will say, I've got an LOI and I need to sell the company, or I want to sell the company. So some of the things that go on that I can do well in advance, and I assume is for your business as well, can't be accomplished: tax planning, estate planning, et cetera. Do you work, or is it traditional that investment bankers work with companies to get their businesses ready for sale?
I imagine having been there, I assume it's like most M&A attorneys, like most M&A bankers. If you get them early, you know that you can get them better prepared, and candidly, you're going to get them more money, a better valuation, and better terms and conditions. But we all know that we get that call that says, hey, I just got this unsolicited offer, or yeah, I've been thinking about this forever, and now I've kind of got high-centered with a couple of buyers, and I think I might need you to come in and help out or run a process. We're basically, you know, the stew's half-baked, and you're asked to step into the kitchen and become the chief chef. So, yeah, I mean, all things considered, if you can get your client early, you can start to help them look at their business and say, how are we going to optimize? Well, first of all, same thing, optimize the range of options that you have by optimizing the value of your business.
Good word.
And that usually involves installing some processes, systems, and controls around in the business. And then, you know, having that hopefully feed up into a management dashboard where you can show to the buyer that you have and can optimize the metrics in your business that influence it. And that's it from a business perspective or concept. From a legal perspective, you know, if you're beginning with the end in mind, or you're thinking about selling, you look at things entirely differently. You look at your contracts with your clients. What's, is there an assignment clause in there? Do I need consent if I assign it? What's, you know, you might have your long-term client, but they're not under a long-term contract. Mm-hmm. And can you get that long? Because when it comes, as you and I know, when it comes to, you know, valuing a company, if you can prove that value up through diligence, and that's when we talk about prospective, but historical diligence typically, and show them that, hey, the cash flows that this business has been kicking off in the past are going to continue in the future because of the documentation we have in place, agreements we have in place. Maybe there's a stickiness to the relationship with your client or your partner that makes it very difficult for them to switch away, go to somebody else, what are called switching costs, you know, such that when somebody's valuing your business, they can see this business is going to not only hold together, it's ready to scale and it has fantastic prospects in front of it. Because at the end of the day, what a buyer's buying you for is not your value necessarily today. It's or your value today is based on what your future cash flows are valued at. And how do you tell that story of the highest value? You document your history and you have the most compelling contracted backlog for sales pipeline for those that are hopefully going to work their way in the contracted backlog and every other prospect of your business. I mean, if it's vendors and it's suppliers that you have great relationship, you have redundancies, it's well documented, it's well thought out, you don't have customer concentration, you don't have supplier concentration, all the things that you know from the years you've been in business and doing what you do, Dave, and I'll respect you because not only are you a great attorney, but a great businessman. And you can, you've seen so many deals that you can look at something and a client will have lived with that risk all their years and thought that's no risk because they're never leaving us or, you know, they're a great partner. Right. We don't need an agreement. But when you go to sell it, the buyer looks at that and sees nothing but risk because, yeah, sure, they were like that with you. What are they going to be like with me? And without that aspect to the business, I don't value, or there's a severe discount to valuation. So starting early in the conversation, planning and preparing, we often say that if you sell your business when you want to retire and it goes well, you probably were lucky. Because things being equal, you should have been monitoring the market conditions, M&A market conditions, and then monitoring your industry to figure out what's the best time to sell. Because some businesses are better sold. And, you know, notwithstanding the fact that you may be not interested in retiring, it may be time for your business to either sell and then you can take the proceeds and go do some other business venture or get into charitable works. Or it may be something that you, I know that you're very familiar with because we've been able to execute this recapitalization where, you know, you've done well. There are some clouds on the industry or there's some opportunities on the industry. And you say, look, I'm going to take some chips off the table. I'm going to sell 51%. I'm going to sell 80%. I'm going to sell 49% of my company to a financial partner. I'm going to take that money off the table, put it in my pocket, diversify myself personally. Then I'm going to have a partner going forward for the opportunities to maybe acquire businesses or grow organically. But now I'm not shoving my chips back in the middle of the table. I'm shoving my financial partner's chips back in the middle of the table. I've diversified, taken money off the table. Or if there's tough times ahead of you, you've also got a deep pocket experienced financial partner to help you weather that storm. So we see more often than not, slightly more often than not, certainly as much as that people seek and are willing to do a recapitalization as much as a sale. Because, and as a quick aside on that one, we all know there's certain scenarios that, you know, your business will be valued higher by a buyer, certainly a financial buyer, private equity firm, family office, hedge fund, if you do an 80-20 recap than if you sold it all. Because with the 80-20 recap, if I'm the owner and I'm key to the business, and I still have skin in the game, I still have 20% on the table, my partner is going to look upon that business and see more value because I'm in it to win it, connected at their hip, as opposed to, thanks for the cash, I'm headed for the beach in the sales scenario. So again, there's facts and circumstances that drive everyone. So, you know, when talking these generalities, there's always exceptions to the rule. But we're just talking about some things that we see a lot. I know you see a lot in our M&A practices.
That's very helpful. What I take away from this, and this may be the tagline, is a great story, usually with a great, what we call a book, that the investment bankers put together, but a great story with great documentation, with optimization, the value of the company equals to a fantastic result.
Yeah. No, I'd say it's kind of axiomatic, right? It's pretty simple. I often say the stuff I do is not, you know, complicated or sophisticated, or I wouldn't be doing it. But when you've done it for 35 years, you've kind of picked up a few tricks of the trade. But at the end of the day, it's common sense. But executing that common sense and having the discipline to plan in advance and to be prepared to sell when the time comes, that's really the differentiation between optimizing and having that fantastic transaction that you just referenced.
That you hit the nail on the head. That was good. Let's talk about 2023. What do you see that's on the horizon? And Pat, having said that, that's an unfair question, because I've been listening to all the prognosticators, and, you know, some people have said, I think the publicly traded companies are saying we're going into a recession. I don't know exactly. You know, there may be a variety of reasons why they may say that. Some self-serving, some are very genuine. I've been listening to podcasts. Yeah, you know, everybody I listen to says there's going to be some course corrections. The high happy times of, I say, 2015, 2016 to 2022 or 2021 may have ended, but there's still great deals out there. There's a lot of money in play. You know, there's just so many opportunities. I don't see that much yet of a change in valuations, but, you know, at some point I begin to think that if you say things long enough, then they actually come true. If you think it's going to be bad, you know, probably will be. This is just a gut level. Nobody can rely on this because we're guessing like everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to gauge it. There are certain drivers to the M&A industry that kind of keep it buoyed and keep it flowing, and that is transitions in the baby boomers and transition in businesses. You have all the money that's out there looking to fund deals. The whole private equity world, the whole financing world. And you have, you know, the cash on the balance sheet of strategics, you know, that are, and so the question is, you know, are the valuations of the sellers going to meet the valuations of the buyers? But, you know, the other thing that's also true, I want to address your question, the quick anomaly here. In every industry or in every environment, there are winners and losers. I mean, I'm thinking right now as we have somewhat unprecedented headwinds when you talk about inflation, labor with the great resignation and supply chain issues. I mean, you'd think that we would be locked up, and we've had a phenomenally lucky and blessed year at Planet Frontier. Having said that, our two deals that were supposed to close at the year end, our lead buyers, one recut their deal, not materially, but recut it because of the headwinds. The other one made a decision at the board level they weren't going forward. Now we have 10 plus offers, but that lead buyer was, you know, 15-20% above. It is higher, and no one, and the other buyer bidders don't know that. But, you know, it hurt to lose that one. And so, you know, we're just now starting to see it. I hope by 2023, I think people are saying, yeah, there's a course correction coming, but hopefully it's not going to be too severe. And if we don't have too many more self-inflicted wounds, it hopefully won't be too severe. And so, I mean, I was going to give one anomaly. We also have some deals that are just going great guns. So we all know what happened during COVID, or we think we know what happened during COVID. Some businesses were rocked. I mean, they were shut down. Other businesses that happened to align with some of the things that were going on during COVID had an unprecedented lift in their business. And we were fortunate enough to sell some of those. And then our argument was, in our discussions with the buyers, were, oh, we think this is going to be sustainable for the following reasons rather than a blip. And the buyers were worried that it was a blip. Well, there's just always things that are going on. We happen to be lucky enough to, and we're referral only, and referred a deal that was not even in the Midwest, but they are in the semiconductor industry. And by legislative edict, you know, semiconductors are to be made on U.S. soil. And if you're part of that, there's a lift, a rising tide lifts all boats, and it's lifting our client, but our client's also fortunate enough to serve one of the leaders in that market. And so, you know, they went from a pretty great business to a business beyond their wildest dreams and staring at a transaction that's beyond their wildest dreams. And so, you know, in almost there's winners and losers in every economy, but certainly when you're facing rising interest rates, which is key for if anybody's going to be using, and most buyers do use some leverage to fund that cash at closing acquisition financing. And so, you know, rising interest rates, inflation, labor issues, and supply chain issues, and any other unrest or, you know, uncertainty out there, you know, that is, all things being equal, potential discount to valuation. Having said that, I mean, you know, capitalism works and the great entrepreneur works, and people find ways to make money and ways to pivot. And most people are not just milking a business. If you're trying to build a business, regardless of the economy, there may acquisitions may make sense to you, or a sale may make sense to you. We often talk about, look at things much like offensive and defensive reasons. Our clients sometimes usually are selling for offensive reasons, mm-hmm. you know, because it's an opportunity to put cash in their pocket, diversify or capitalize on something that's happening in the market where they go out and find a complementary offering to what they have going right now to further dominate their market or to take over their market. But some people do stuff for defensive reasons too. And it doesn't have to be, you know, like you're running scared. It's just prudent to say if you see something coming in your industry, if your industry is maturing and you think you need to diversify, you make an acquisition or you sell off a division that you think's not going to serve you in the future. So it's a great game of business. We're all lucky to play in it. And so 2023, who knows? I'm hoping and praying that the course correction recession is not long lived, that it doesn't rock us all too much. And that some of us can remember when interest rates where they are now were not too bad. Money wasn't right. Always free. We just went through a period that you just referenced there, where literally, if you talk to the bankers, you know, it's just that, you know, not to get into financial thought, but there's an innate cost of money, and it most people would say that we've been trading money at below that rate. So the course correction is kind of how I refer to it, as opposed, although, you know, again, some self-inflicted things and some other things, just the hot economy, we probably are ready for a little recession. But, you know, there's opportunities to buy during a recession. There's opportunities to go get some, you know, financing, some jet fuel, some growth capital to go roll up an industry or take out some competitors. There's always potentially strategic moves that can really, really move the needle in your business. And that's why you and I do what we do.
Right. Good analysis. I mean, that's one of the better explanations I've heard from anybody, Pat, candidly. And that's the way I think people ought to look at it. So thank you.
Well, you know, even as one of my former partners I learned under had told me, he said, you know, even a blind squirrel can find a nut, but don't count on that every day. So if I did stumble into something there, it's probably me just repeating what I'm seeing in the market. But it's still a great market. I mean, maybe I'm not being too Pollyanna. I still think deals are going to get done. Yes. I think there's going to be some challenges to them, certainly for certain buyers where the headwinds don't affect them or maybe lift them or fill their sales. But deals are going to get done in 2022. We're going to have two that close in the first quarter, but, you know, big ones that for us. But we're excited where this is going. We wish we weren't, you know, dealing with the issues we are dealing, but now that we're dealing with them, let's deal with them and move to a market where there are fewer impediments to fantastic deals.
Okay. Excellent. If you were to give potential sellers two or three real bullet points of advice, if they want to get engaged in M&A, what would you say to them? Or what would you share with them, I should say?
Yeah, you know, I would probably say, besides that, start early and get ready. That's kind of a throwaway. We've already discussed that. I'd probably say, be cognizant of when and how you should sell. I'll come back on these later. Understand and be prepared to prove out your valuation. And the third one is run a competitive marketing process. And that's just not me selling what I do, what we do here at Frontier. That's, you know, buyers are in the business of paying you one penny more than they have to buy your business. And only through, there's certain nuanced ways and certain deals and certain facts and circumstances where you can move the needle, but nothing consistently moves the needle like a competitive process where people buyers are forced to put their best and final offer on the table. And then the sell side client gets to choose from that. So let me back up into the two I mentioned before that lead to that. The one is, I mentioned this before, be cognizant of when it's right to sell. I mean, are you running into a market where, like, was it last year, my years are going away, when there was a discussion of capital gains changing and some people that were thinking about selling, I think got to get a deal done, close this year in case Congress messes with the capital gains rate or something like that. Be cognizant with the market and the interest rates and stuff like that, but really be cognizant of what's happening in your industry and where are the opportunities and where, you know, if you got a tsunami coming, you want to make sure your surfboard is waxed and you're ready to ride. If you've got headwinds coming, you want to be ready to tuck and roll into that. So not just run your business, but also take some time to step out, particularly when you go to your association industry get-togethers, and try to figure out, you know, where you play in that and when's the optimal time to sell part of or all of your business, or step on the gas and start acquiring businesses to really exponentially blow up your business. So it's a timing aspect. That's the first one. And I mentioned the recap one before. This could be a personal timetable where you're just going like, I never thought I'd right. be sitting here with a $20 million EBITDA company, and I better take some chips off the table simply for diversification purposes, because all my wealth is wrapped up in this closely held private business, and who knows what's going to happen. Or I'm going to take some chips off the table, and I want to get a financial partner because I've got some great opportunities in this industry, and I want to have them put their chips down middle of the table for us to go do these acquisitions or to step on our organic growth plans. And so that's a timing aspect. Then the second one I referenced was understanding and preparing how to prove up valuation. The last 12 months, people talk about in our business, TTM, trailing 12 month, or LTM, last 12 months, financials, EBITDA and EBITDA margin, your cash flow margin are incredibly important, but they're important just initially because it's part of the financing. Your lender's certainly going to be looking at that. Your buyer's lender is going to be looking at that for how much they can lend. And then how much a buyer can lend affects how much a buyer can pay, because their equity is going to marry with the debt, or if they have mezzanine involved, of what that full purchase price. So you want to have a stout history. In a perfect world, you've got a nice upward trend of CAGR, compounded annual growth rate of your business. But you want to have solid historical results. But those historical results are really most important if you're going to really ring the bell, is because they're a basis for your projections. Because what you're really trying to do is, you know, I mentioned LTM. Our buyers always like to talk in LTM. We always like to talk about run rate, where we're going, where our clients going. Mm-hmm. And so how do you make those projections? I mean, let's face it, most middle market companies do not do projections, and they probably don't do projections because it's a waste of time for them. Because who are they doing projections for? They don't have to do it unless their bank kind of wanted something. But having some projections that you can put together and you can support can really move the needle on the value of your business. And how can you support it? You support it with a tight contracted backlog. Here's all of the deals we have under contract. Here's clients with 5-year agreements, and we can show you we're in year one of this 5-year, and this client we're in year four, but we've got a renewal clause, and you can build out. You're not just swagging. You're not just saying, oh, we're going to do 5% next year and 10% after that because we think something good's happening in the industry. You're literally doing a ground-up analysis based on your business, why those projections, based on your LTM numbers, are believable. And that's where the business is going. And therefore, a buyer, when they're populating their pricing model, we haven't really talked about that, but buyers are looking at those projections, certainly discounting them, or more likely than not discounting them. But if you give them, show them your work, you've got the documentation that supports your projections, they're going to have their assumptions that drive their pricing model are going to be more robust. They've got more to hang their hat on. And so they can afford to pay more because they expect this business to continue to increase its cash flow in the future. And they did so because you showed them a stout contracted backlog, because you showed them a stout sales pipeline and how you've worked that sales pipeline successfully into contracted backlog, successfully into an existing client, successfully into a long-term client. And then the other thing too is you've got growth initiatives. If you're in a business, and I don't want to go down a rat hole here, but many times people will be talking to them about their business and we're saying, look, you know, help us tell your story, and we want to amplify the strengths, and we want to, every business has weaknesses, so let's disclose them and manage to them. Then let's get to telling your story going forward and what this business could be. And they, oh gosh, this business could do this, this, and this. We never did it. I probably should have. And we often say, don't beat yourself up. What you're doing, what you're doing was perfect for you in a right. successful business to have stretched to right. do something like that on your own nickel. That's probably imprudent. The risk associated with that stretch probably was not worth the take. But once you've got a financial partner who wants to and needs to grow because they have to get a return to their investors, they want you to take that. So take that growth initiative and don't just have it be a gleam in your eye. Have worked up some plans. Have talked to some people in the industry. Maybe have some, you know, exchange some documentation. Maybe a PowerPoint deck where you contemplated a joint venture and you're going to go after something new. So that when you show projections, there's something more than, hey, this business has done, you know, ABC for its last 20 years. It could really do D, E, and F really well, but we just have never done it. And they say, oh, okay. And then they'll evaluate whether D, E, and F can get done, those different initiatives. But if you've explored plans and already talked to people and vetted them and shown them a thoughtful process of how you would execute on D, E, and F, the projections associated with D, E, and F become that much more believable and therefore are likely to move your valuation and your sale price. So at the end of the day, I guess if I was talking about, yeah, be cognizant of when you can and should sell or be looking to sell or be open to selling. Understand and be prepared, probably the biggest one, to prove up your valuation. And then finally, when you run it, I don't mean to sell you, but you don't have to use Frontier, but I would definitely engage a seasoned, if you're of a size that you're a business broker, engage a business broker. If you're of the size where you're in the investment banking aisle, engage an investment bank with experience and have them orchestrate a competitive process so that they can drive and optimize valuation for you. So I was telling you a little bit there, Dave, but
no,
I can't help
it. You know, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the day, that I'm fired up now. I'm ready to go out and do a deal. But that's always the way it is when I'm done with Pat. Pat, thanks so much. Great insight, very transparent, very authentic. Great thoughts, some suggestions and secrets that would be invaluable to anyone who is interested in selling their business. Pat, how do they find out more about you and Frontier Investment Banking? How do they contact you?
Well, you can find us on the web, and now I'm embarrassed to say this because we haven't updated our website for well over a year and a half. We probably have 5 to 7 deals we need to add to that. But yeah, you can find our contact information at www.frontieribc, I for investment, B for banking, C for corporation.com. And if you can stomach me, I know you're going to like everybody else because they're certainly smarter than I am, and they're more engaging. So we'd love to represent whomever would be interested in optimizing and sale of their business. And if we can, we'd love to optimize that with you, Dave, because we know you got a great team over there and we enjoy working with you.
Listen, you want Pat because Pat is enthusiastic and high energy. And I'm going to tell you, if you're going to do a deal, you need somebody enthusiastic and very high energy. Thanks again, Pat, and thanks to all of our listeners. If you're in search or in need of assistance, please go to davidsider.com and schedule a free consultation. Also, please subscribe to the show, rate it, leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Until next time, have a good day. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every person or business. In determining the best outcome and course of action, business owners should consult with their attorney on their distinct circumstances.